The One by Lillian DeWaters, Chapter 2, The Message of Truth. An illumined one has written the following inspiring words, quote, "Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart." End quote. What a world of spiritual food is contained in these words. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. What does this mean? It means that before the inner eye, the eye of soul, beholds for you the oneness of being, your outer eyes, your senses, must be closed to grief. Why do we weep tears of grief? Is it not because of the notion of personality? Have we not wept because of what people said about us? Because of the way they treated us? Because of the sense of injustice or hurt that we felt? Have we not wept over our own shortcomings and failures? Have we not wept because of the seeming separation of our loved ones? Can you see now that all such grief hinges upon the belief of a separate self, a selfhood that other than the One? If we are seeing and knowing the omnipresence of the One Being, would there be any reason for tears or grief? When we have in us this wondrous vision of the One Being eternally at hand, our eyes will be healed of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Have you not received a message from another that caused you to feel great fear, worry, misery? Have you not heard others speak when their words acted like a knife entering your heart? Have you not listened to gossip, slander, criticism when it made you confused, fearful, sick? As soon as your inner ear has heard the voice of the Master, the message of truth, then your outer ears will be dull of hearing. We must be insensible to the hearing of error, knowing there is but one voice which speaketh no evil, but is ever self, with a capital S, conscious of its own being. When gossip, criticism, evil tidings reach our ears and cause not a ripple upon our clear perception of the one and only being, then we find our joy is complete, is lasting, and no man can take it from us. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, the illumined, it must have lost the power to wound. Is your voice the voice of a personal being, or is your voice the voice of truth? When we speak from the consciousness of the one being and the nothingness of any other being, then our voice carries no power to wound, for it is truth speaking to truth. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, be conscious of its own glory, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. Does this mean that we must suffer troubles, agonies, fears, griefs before we can lay claim to a clear perception of the One? Does it mean that experience leads us to truth? Experience cannot add to that which is already complete. And as we understand this aright, we are bathed in the glory of the Lord. We are illumined. We are inspired. We are glorified. When we see the nothingness of experience, the nothingness of a selfhood apart from God, the nothingness of a world of evil, the nothingness of birth, sin, sickness, death, then our eyes are incapable of tears, our ears have lost their sensitiveness, our voice has lost its power to wound, and our hearts have been bathed in the glory of the light. Great men and women of this world may have been led away from the upward vision, the high watch, by not holding fast to the consciousness of the one and only being, the same in every heart. As soon as the vision sees oneself as greater than another, greater in power, greater in intelligence, greater in authority, that instant one has turned from the light and the glory of truth. To see the nothingness of a personal being is to walk in a world of charm and magic, a world of delight and glory, a world peopled with heavenly beings. When we see the self of each one as the one self, with a capital S, then we no longer struggle to outshine, for he who believes himself in any way superior to his fellow men is incapable of discipleship. All the power there is, all the intelligence there is, stands present now for you and for me alike, and no one can lay claim to it more than another. Now all the dream of experience asks is for someone to believe in it, someone to bow down and worship it, someone to tremble because of it, someone to run for fear of it. And if one believes in a personal man, he is believing in the dream, and the dream will dance him into trouble until that hour strikes for him when he sees the nothingness of matter, the nothingness of mind, and the nothingness of personality, and the nothingness of the dream itself. Then he is the God-crowned man. Let us acknowledge truth in all our ways. Let us acknowledge impersonal man at hand now and here. The way of redemption is not by way of destruction. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill, spoke he who had bathed the feet of his disciples. We are not to eradicate evil from the world, nor is the world to be healed by right thinking or people to be made over through methods of concentration and adjustment. Redemption of the world consists not in healing, but in knowing the truth. Redemption consists in knowing the nothingness of the dream rather than in changing the dream. The way of healing sickness on the material plane is through the device of drugs, knives, climates, etc. This is but changing the dream. The way of healing on the mental plane is through the device of thought, the control of the body through the mind. This, too, aims to bring about a change in the dream. For instance, from the dream of being sick and in trouble to the change called healing. Changing dreams, while helpful, does not bring the millennium on earth, nor does it take away from the face of the whole world the notion of birth, sin, disease, death. Nothing but knowing the allness of truth and the nothingness of a separate world, the nothingness of a dream world, can bring full emancipation. We have been taught truly that man actually is a perfect being living in joy and harmony in heaven, and that this earthly existence is like a dream state, fleeting, chimerical. Now the actual state and the earthly state can be clearly understood through the illustration of our daily experience and our nightly experience, which illustration is as follows. A man partakes of a hearty meal and lies down in comfort and strength to indulge in quiet sleep. He dreams, and in his dream he finds himself walking along the street very weak and hungry. So feeble is he, so weak from lack of food, that he needs to support himself by resting against the side of a building. Now what shall he do? How can this man in the dream be helped? One can readily see that the dreamer is laboring under a delusion, for all the time that he believes he is walking on the street hungry and weak, he is in some place else. He is in his own room, warm, strong, comfortable. He believes he is where he is not, and he is not consciously aware of his right and true position. Thus, man on earth, wandering in a world of birth, change, sin, sickness, death, believes he is where he is not, and he is not consciously aware of his actual, changeless, perfect state in heaven. It is asked, how is spiritual treatment given from the absolute position? That is, if one does not look to drugs or to right thoughts for healing, then how does one think or act when he practices from the absolute position? Continuing the illustration of the man on the couch dreaming that he is walking along the street faint with hunger, we will assume someone standing by his bedside awake, someone who has the power to know the nature of this man's dream and who sees him weak and faint from lack of food. How shall this man who is awake help the man who is walking on the street faint and hungry? The answer to this question will also answer the one, how does the practitioner who knows the truth help the man who comes into his office sick and weak? Imagine, in his desire to help his hungry friend, that the man at the bedside rushes into the kitchen and prepares a hearty meal of delicious food, which he brings on a tray and places by the sleeper directly at his elbow. Here, then, is the sleeper dreaming that he is famishingly hungry, and here also is his friend aware of his dream and placing food directly at his elbow. Will this be of any avail? None whatever. For the man who is dreaming that he is hungry has his eyes closed to the plate of food that is touching his elbow. If only the man who is walking on the street, hungry, could but know of this plate of sumptuous food. But how can he, since he is but fiction, illusion? Now, since there is no such man existing as the hungry man on the street, he cannot partake of the plate of food. And the dreamer, the one lying on the couch, why should he partake of food when only an hour previously he dined sumptuously and is not at all weak and hungry, but is strong and perfectly nourished? Is it clear to you thus far that the man in the dream, hungry, cannot be fed, for there is no such man, and that the man on the bed does not need to eat because he is not hungry? The idea of bringing the plate of food to the bedside of the sleeper symbolizes material means of healing. That is, when one approaches a medical physician for help, this physician fixes his attention on appearances, on the sick body, and he prescribes drugs or operation for the body. He looks at the picture and applies his help directly to the picture. Again, suppose that the man at the bedside of the dreamer has a little more insight into the situation than this, and he thinks, "Now, it will do no good to place food at the bedside of this dreamer, for he is not actually hungry. He only believes that he is hungry. I cannot help him directly. That is, I cannot help him by forcing the food into his body, for he really does not require food, but I can help him indirectly. As long as it is only belief, if I can change his belief from being hungry to the belief of finding and eating food, he will then have his problem solved." So the man awake, standing at the bedside of the man asleep, delivers a mental treatment, paying no heed to the body of the dreamer, but fixing his attention upon his mind, he speaks to him silently like this: "Do not stand at the plate glass window of that bakery and starve for food, but go right into the shop, sit down and eat. You will then feel well and strong again." Without a doubt, it is pleasanter even in a dream to sit at a table and eat dream food than it is to stand weak and hungry without. But our point of consideration is, how shall one deliver help from the absolute position? We have heard that as a man thinketh, so he is, inferring that all one has to do is to change his belief, and he can be as he will. Now, with such a conception of life, a mental practitioner would not attend to the picture as does the medical physician, for he believes that the way to change the picture is to produce a change in the mind of the patient, and then the picture will change automatically. Using the device of changing thoughts in the mentality has brought better conditions to many, yet it can be readily seen that changing the earthly dream from sickness to health, from poverty to plenty, has not done away with the dream itself. For so-called sickness, sin, birth, change, death continue in this world as previously. Now, what else is there for the man at the bedside to do? If he does not provide actual food for his friend or deliver mental treatment to his mind, then how shall he help him? For his desire is to take away this false belief and deliver to him a happy, peaceful experience. The question is, if I do not use drugs, material means directly upon the body of one who claims sickness, and if I do not direct my right thoughts to his mind, endeavoring to change his thought from sickness to health, then what is the way? How shall I proceed if I ignore both the body and the mind of the patient? The words of the master physician are still vibrant in this world today. Know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. One immediately asks, but how can I know without thinking? Take ye no thought, for in an hour, when ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. The truth is revealed to you. How can one know without thinking? This question may be answered by asking another. How can one get into a mirror without getting into a mirror? When you wish to see how you look, you stand before a mirror, do you not? There is no labor attached to this. You do not put a hole in the mirror to make room for your reflection. You do not have to throw yourself at the mirror or put forth any effort whatsoever. You merely stand still before the mirror, and it is done. Without acting, without thinking, there you are in the mirror. How can one know anything and still not think? Now, the mind is like a mirror. It reflects, and when one knows truth, it has nothing whatever to do with his mind any more than there is a connection between a person and the mirror. But the mind reflects intelligence. And as one gets into the mirror, so to speak, without effort or strain, so does one know the truth without an actual process of thought taking place at all. This is what is called spiritual consciousness. Take ye no thought. You do not go to the mirror to see how or why that image of yourself is there, for you cannot find out. The picture in the mirror is not coming out of the mirror. The image in the mirror is seen there because you are standing before it. And likewise, true thoughts come not from the mentality, but are seen and felt in the mentality because one is standing before the light. This is the great principle of reflection, which enables us to see ourselves as we are, see ourselves in the finished kingdom. Look unto me is the command of the superworld, the message of truth. Turning away from all else, one looks steadfastly into heaven, reality, and immediately his mind is flooded with thoughts of love, wholeness, abundance, joy, peace, and glory. God is the Holy Ghost, the great light, and as man looks into this light, what does he see? What can anyone see who looks into the white mirror but himself? And so man sees himself, and his mind is lighted, and his body is lighted, and still he has been thoughtless. To see clearly that thoughts of truth do not spring from the mentality, that knowing truth is not a conscious mental process, but is the act of truth itself. To look to soul, to the only being there is, rather than to attend to one's mind, is to come into a clear vision, a new country. To see that thoughts of truth come from truth, soul, and not from mentality, is to experience great joy and freedom. We should surely have and enjoy true thoughts with no more labor than we breathe the air or expand our lungs. The act of truth is not a motion, not a process, not a method, not a procedure. It has nothing whatever to do with time and space, but it is a self-consciousness. True knowing itself, spiritual consciousness. Therefore, to know the truth does not mean to deliberately, consciously use the mind to formulate thoughts as one would grind out coffee from a coffee mill. But knowing the truth is that paradox, wherein it is stated, when I am weak, then am I strong. Here now we have the man standing by the bedside of his sleeping friend, wishing to help him, wishing to use the highest practice, and hearing the words of the all-knowing Jesus, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." What is the truth that this man is to know for his friend? He is to know, first of all, that his friend dined but a short time ago, that he is not hungry, and that he does not need any food. This is the simple truth. He does not know this in order that the man will stop being hungry, but on the contrary, he knows this because he recognizes that this is the truth. As he sees the man in the dream wandering on the street, weak and hungry, he knows that it is only a picture man, having no substance to it whatsoever, for there is his friend right before his eyes, lying quietly and peacefully on the bed. Therefore, he is not deceived by appearances. He does not go out into the dream and take the dream man into a dream restaurant. Neither does he direct mental treatment to his mind, thereby to assuage his hunger. But he stands still, facing the truth, knowing that both the dream and the man in the dream are nothing, and knowing the safety and wholeness of the man where he actually is. The dream, which is nothing, being only a picture in the mind of the sleeper, then ceases. With this illustration in mind, we come now to the practitioner of truth, who is before him a patient asking for help. It may be that this one says he is sick or sorrowful or fearful. Such is the picture man who approaches the one who is to help him. The practitioner, using the highest practice, has taken for his foundation, the truth is all there is, and besides the truth, there is nothing else. Therefore, who is this that approaches him? Is it a being called John Doe who is sick and in trouble? How can this be if truth is all? The practitioner is not deluded into administering treatment to the sick body or the sick mind, but with vision fixed clearly on the truth of being, the rock of ages, he knows the nothingness of mortal mind and mortal man, and he understands the oneness and omnipresence of perfect being. He knows that when he looks upon what seems a sick man, there is no such man present any more than there was a hungry man in the dream. Therefore, the highest practice, the mount of fulfillment, is simply knowing the truth, knowing the allness of perfect being and its reflection, and knowing the nothingness of any other being or belief. Such knowing is not an operation of mind or process of thought, but is spiritual consciousness, self-conscious of the allness and oneness of being. Why is it that the one called patient will find himself restored to harmony? Because of the nothingness of his dream and the oneness of man. When one man knows the truth, it includes the one called patient, for man is one. This oneness is the love of God. Man knows the truth not with cold reason and logic, but with love and faith. It is as one looks with the vision of a pure heart, as one recognizes the Jesus Christ presence, as the one and only that he is able to see the nothingness of dreams, of shadows, of fiction. The practitioner clearly perceives the nothingness of personality, the nothingness of any self separate from God, the nothingness of any mind but the divine mind or intelligence, which does not dream, the nothingness of any body but the body of truth, the image and likeness of God. It is our ignorance of God, truth, that brings forth these dream pictures of good and evil, right and wrong. But the understanding of the one being enables us to lay hold upon reality, which is at hand untouched by any dream about it. Now, spiritual man is not in this apparent world any more than you are in your dream. When you dream that you are across the ocean, you never actually leave your couch, nor does spiritual man exist in a false world. A world of birth, change, and death. Spiritual man is never born, is never sick, and never dies. When in your sleep you believe that you are falling off a precipice or running from a wild animal, the precipice and the wild animal exist only in your mind, in your belief, and so are wholly mental. Your fear, your suffering in the dream is entirely a mental state, self-created, although you are ignorant of this fact. You do not actually leave your couch to fall off a precipice. You leave the couch in belief only, which is the same as not leaving it at all. You see this clearly and accept it without protest. So in this world, when man reports pain, sickness, trouble, you must also clearly perceive that it is in his mind only, self-created, although he is ignorant of this fact, while all the time he is a perfect being living in a perfect world. Man does not actually leave heaven, the perfect state of life, in order to experience pain in a false world, and to live in a false world in belief is the same as not living in a false world at all. This insight shows one clearly the nothingness of mind, the nothingness of belief, the nothingness of experience, and the nothingness of false man. This is the conclusion of chapter 2 of The One by Lillian DeWaters.